Hello and welcome. I am Alfonso Iorio. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us today, educational activity titled One Size Does Not Fit All, using population pharmacokinetics for tailored hemophilia care. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians around the globe. The goal of today's activity is to enable our learners to provide individualized treatment to their patients with hemophilia. Again, I am Alfonso Iorio. I am professor of medicine at the Department of Health Research Methods, Evidence and Impact, and hold the Bayer and Doe Chair for Clinical Epidemiology of Bleeding Disorders at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Joining me today are my colleagues, Dr. Mark Redding and Dr. Miguel Escobar. Miguel is professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston McGovern Medical School and the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. He's also the medical director of the Gulf States Hemophilia and Thrombophilia Center in Houston, Texas. Great to have you with us, Miguel.
Thank you to be here.
Mark is an associate professor of medicine and director of the Center for Bleeding and Clotting Disorders at the University of Minnesota Medical Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Happy to have you with us, Mark.
Thanks, great to be here.
Okay, let's start with our first learning objective, which is to summarize the comparative PK data and the clinical significance of population PK studies on factor VIII replacement therapies. I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes to introduce our audience to hemophilia. Hemophilia is a bleeding congenital disorder. We have two main diseases, hemophilia A, deficiency of factor VIII, and hemophilia B, deficiency of factor IX. Both are X-linked, and as such, they affect mostly males, but they can also affect sporadically females. Females are usually carrier, they have enough of the factor to clot, but sometimes they have impaired coagulation. Also worth mentioning that there are sporadic cases that appears without a family history. Now, hemophilia is a rare disease, but is not really that rare. A recent paper in 2019 on Annals has reestablished the prevalence of hemophilia in the population, and essentially we expect one case in about 3,000 males, or six severe cases of hemophilia A per 100,000 patients. So it's rare, but it will happen to see too many hematologists in the field. The important concept is that hemophilia is treatable. Hemophilia patients, they bleed, and severe hemophiliacs, they bleed spontaneously, moderate and mild, they bleed for trauma, intense physical activity or surgery. When they bleed, we can stop bleeding, but joint start deteriorating. And once the bleed happen, the damage is done. So the best approach to treat hemophilia is preventing bleeds. Preventing bleeds is achieved through giving them factor concentrates, IV, on a regular basis, starting where they are children. And there is literature showing that you can reduce the bleeding risk by about 80% by treating patients on what we call continuous prophylaxis. It's a simple concept, but it gets more complicated when you translate it into practice, because we are lucky to have many factor concentrate, but they are not all the same. So I'd like you, Mark, to start guiding us into which kind of factor concentrate do we have available.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it is complicated because we have many, many tools in the toolbox, so to speak. We have a lot of different factor products to pick from, and they aren't all the same. I think we can break these down into two big buckets. We have standard half-life products, and more recently, we've seen the development and the availability of extended half-life products. The difference between a standard half-life product and an extended half-life product is that the extended half-life, or EHL product, has been modified. The factor VIII protein has been modified in a way to prolong the time that it lasts in the circulation. So when we compare the EHL drugs to the standard half-life drugs, we see there's about a 1.5-fold prolongation of half-life. And, you know, this is not quite as much as we'd hoped for. We were hoping for a much longer prolongation, but the issue here is that we're limited by the biology in terms of factor VIII being bound to von Willebrand factor, which is another clotting protein. So we're really limited. We can extend the half-life of factor VIII, but we're limited by the half-life of von Willebrand factor, to which factor VIII has to be bound in the circulation. So when we look at the EHL products and the standard half-life products, for an individual patient, the difference in half-life prolongation may be greater or less depending on the patient. So there's a lot of individual variability. Particularly in small children, we may not see that the difference is so great in terms of translating into a clinically meaningful difference in how often we'd have to infuse to protect from bleeding. When it comes to the EHL drugs compared to each other, again, the PK differences may seem relatively small, but for individual patients, this sometimes translates into clinically meaningful differences. And so we do have some head-to-head data that we can talk about that'll speak to that and give us a sense of how we make a decision about which of these many products that we can choose from to treat our patients.
Thank you very much, Mark. Now, I'll ask for your help again. There are a few different extended half-life concentrate on the market. I'd like you to quickly comment on each of them, and feel free to use the brand name, the molecular name, as too complicated for us to use them.
Sure. So there's a table on the screen that shows the currently available extended half-life factor VIII products. And as you can see, the first one of these was available in 2014 in the U.S., and then most recently another one became available just in the last year. These products differ in terms of the factor VIII component. So two of these are B domain deleted factor VIII molecules. One is an intact full-length molecule. The other has a small portion of the B domain attached, so it's a B domain truncated molecule. Probably the biggest difference between these products is the manner in which the half-life has been extended. So one of these is an Fc fusion protein, the others are pegylated, but amongst the pegylated products there are also differences. So if we take a look at the size of the PEG moiety, if we look at the manner in which PEG is attached, whether it's randomly attached or whether it's site-specifically attached, these are also differences between these products. And whether that translates into any clinically meaningful difference is still the subject of a lot of investigation. We can see, as we look at the recommended doses of these products, they're definitely not the same. Now, the recommended dosing intervals are based in part on how the clinical trials were done, but they also reflect some biologic differences between these products. And so when you take a look at the dosing schedules, you can't just use the same dosing schedule for each product because they're all a little bit different. So that does make this more complicated and really speaks to the need to tailor our treatment and really understand the characteristics of each product that we might use. If we think about how well these products work, I think it's safe to say that they're all equally effective in terms of providing prophylaxis, treating breakthrough bleeds, covering for surgical management. I don't think there's any significant difference between them. And there really aren't any significant safety issues. I think we all are convinced these products are all equally effective and equally safe.
Thank you very much. So we have made a great point. We can prevent bleeds. We have many tools. They are all effective, but they are different. And you also mentioned a very important point. It's not just the variability in the drugs that matters. It's also the difference between individual patient. And we all know patient may bleed more or less. They may have bled in their past more or less and have target joints where they bleed more often. And patients are like all other human beings. They may be more or less active, have different goals in life. All of these has to be taken into account. One additional component that needs to be taken into account is that every patient handles the factor concentrate we administer in a different way. There are fast clearers, slow clearers, and so on. This is what goes under the name of pharmacokinetics. And here is where treaters usually start getting uncomfortable, saying, well, pharmacokinetics is a complicated concept. I'll call you up now, Miguel, to try to help us understand why PK is important and what does it actually do to treating individual patients.
Yeah, our goal as hemophilia treaters is usually to minimize bleeding into the joints, into the other areas, and we usually have a desired target level. And that is when I think the PKs play an important role. And the typical examples of these are surgery, as Mark mentioned, prophylaxis, Even after patients undergo ITI. For example, in surgery, I mean, it's something that, there are guidelines out there that kind of give you an idea of what is the ideal level to maintain a patient depending on the complexity of this, of the procedure. And you can do it with boluses, you can do it with continuous infusion, but either way, it's important to be able to measure, to be able, especially those peaks and troughs are critical during the surgical setting, because it will give us an idea really, where that target level is and when to make adjustments. And if we are not able to do those measurements, then, the patients can either start bleeding or can start having other complications. Now, in the setting of prophylaxis, I think nowadays more and more, we certainly are using these PK profiles. I think for prophylaxis, especially the trough levels are quite important. And it is a good way to know, the patient is staying above that threshold level that we want to give or that we think it is appropriate for that individual. Now, when it comes to ITI, especially patients that, let's say, are successful in the ITI, I think it's important to be able to do some of these studies to, first of all, figure out, what is their recovery? That patient has a normal recovery, and what is the half-life? A lot of these patients end up with short half-life, but that's important to know because that's going to tell you or give you a good idea on how are you going to be dosing this individual.
Okay, so essentially, there's a lot of pharmacokinetic reasoning that we do in our clinical activity while treating patients that is there, no matter if we call it pharmacokinetics or not. Good. That's the second very important point for us to bring on. Now, let's spiral down and look more closely to comparative data we may have available to compare different extended half-life concentrate. As you know, data can come from different kind of studies, and you can have a population given a concentrate and another completely unrelated population given another. We all know these are rare patients, this group may be different. So the strongest study design to compare two drugs is to have the same population being treated with both. We call this study head-to-head comparisons. And these are stronger because you sort of minimize the variability patient to patient and you focus on the difference that is added by the specific concentrate. We are lucky enough that we have two studies comparing head-to-head extended half-life concentrate in this field, and I'd like to quickly introduce one of them. This was a study done in Canada where concentrates are available through national tenders. So even if it was an observational study, it was quite comprehensive because all patients in this specific center in Toronto between 12 and 18 years of age were initially on Eloctate and all had to switch over a short period of time to Adynovate because of a change in the supply. And they were studied with a PK study before and after. It was not a formal PK study, was a population PK-based assessment done while they were on prophylaxis. But essentially, was done with the same methodology before and after. A central lab doing all the measurement, both clotting and chromogenic. Now, the main result of the study showed that the two extended half-life, Eloctate and Adynovate, in this same population were essentially identical. The line that shows the average profile in the population was completely superimposed one to the other. At a population level, no difference. But if you look on the graph at the individual points at different time after the sampling, they are spread over a wide space. So the concentrates are the same on average, but they are quite different one patient to another. And what is more important, not every patient doing best on one does best on the other. The slide you saw showed you that some patients were doing better on Eloctate and did a bit worse on Adynovate, and some other were instead doing better on Eloctate, bit worse on Adynovate. So, notwithstanding they are the same on average, there were some difference. This study also showed another important concept for us to keep in mind, that patients with blood group type O had on average shorter half-life, both on Adynovate or Eloctate. And that's because of the von Willebrand effect that you, Mark, were mentioning before. While patients of blood group A, B, or AB, they were doing on average better. This all speaks to we need to look at individual patient to make sure we give the appropriate dose, the appropriate interval, treatment interval to each one of them. This is the first study and was an observation done as part of clinical practice. I'd like you, Mark, to comment on the other study that compared that to to extended half-life, the one that is on screen right now.
Sure. Yeah, so this is a slightly different study design. This was not done as part of routine clinical practice as the previous study that you reviewed. But this is essentially an attempt to directly compare head-to-head Eloctate and Jivi. The patients in this study are a little bit older, so they're aged 18 to 65, so a slightly older population. A very simple study design. These are all patients with severe hemophilia A, no previous history of inhibitor, the type of patients we see in our clinics. So it's a simple crossover. In other words, the subjects were randomized. There were 18 that they started with. They divided them into two groups. Each group received a single dose of one product or the other. Same dose, 60 units per kilogram of either Eloctate or Jivi. And then there was at least a 7-day period of time after that one dose, and then they switched over and they received the opposite drug. Around each of those two doses, there was a comprehensive PK assessment done. So a PK assessment done based on factor levels right before, and then at multiple time points after each dose of each medication out to about 5 days. So a sort of an old-fashioned, comprehensive, really dense PK sampling. So when we looked at the results of that, we see some differences. So there are a lot of pharmacokinetic variables that you can consider, but if we take a look at the three that I think probably reflect mostly what we're thinking about in our clinical practice, we think about area under the curve. We saw in this particular set of data that the area under the curve, or the AUC for Jivi, was 25% higher than it was for Eloctate. Coincident with that, we see that clearance was about 20% lower with Jivi, which is what you would expect. Now, when it comes to half-life, the difference was relatively small. So Jivi had about a 7% longer half-life compared to Eloctate. And although that number seems small, when you think about how that may translate into clinical practice, if we use a population PK model and we look at the time it takes to get to the various trough levels, Miguel mentioned the importance of troughs. So if we look at how long it took to get to a trough of 10% or 5%, 3% or 1%, and we take a look at the difference between Jivi and Eloctate from these data, we can see that at each of those target trough levels, it takes on average about 12 hours longer to get there with Jivi than it does with Eloctate. And so this could, in fact, translate into a clinically significant difference for a given patient when you start to think about it takes 12 hours longer to get to your target trough. What might that reflect then in terms of dosing interval and degree of protection and so on? So from these head-to-head data, I think we can say that the PK profile of Jivi appears to be superior. Whether that translates into a clinically meaningful benefit for an individual patient is a slightly different question, but at least we have some head-to-head comparison data showing that there are some differences between these two products.
Thank you very much. It's a lot of information. Would you try, Miguel, to summarize the joint message of these two studies for our audience?
Yeah, I think these are two very important studies where, you know, three different factor VIII products were, you know, allies, if we can say that. The first study was, you know, the Eloctate versus the Adynovate study that came from Canada. It was mostly in children and adolescents. And here, when they looked at the PK profiles between the Eloctate and Adynovate, there was really not a statistically significant difference, but they did see some variability among the individuals. And I think that's important, you know, always to look at and analyze. Now, the other study was the Jivi versus the Eloctate. That was a head-to-head crossover, and the population was maybe a little bit older than the other study. And here they see that Jivi had probably an improved PK profile, definitely compared to the Eloctate. So, you know, I think in the clinical setting, you know, comes the question, you know, what do clinicians or what do physicians should do when they have, let's say, three products like that, and what is the best option for them maybe to sit down with their patient and have that discussion?
Okay, thank you very much. I guess this ends our first learning objective, but as Miguel was telling us right now, we have now a second, even more important objective. Let's talk about how we can individualize dosing regimen for our patient with hemophilia A. I'll call you back up again, Miguel. Can you guide us about the basics of tailoring treatment for hemophilia?
Yeah, I think the tailoring dosing or the individualized dosing that we can call it too, I think the most important part of here is really to try to maximize our treatment. And the way we can do that, I mean, certainly, you know, using some of this new, we can say, technology, because the idea is to try to maybe try to reduce the amount of factor that we infusion, but without changing how effective it is. This could really have a huge impact, especially in the economical part. You know, if you're using less factor but is equally effective, I think that is a win-win situation. You know, especially let's say for countries where their budget is very limited for the management of hemophilia can be a really big help. Now, the other thing we now know certainly is that peaks and troughs again play an important role. You know, we used to pay probably a lot of attention in the recovery, but I think nowadays with the more of the information that has come out, we've seen that certainly these other variables are also quite important. So I think our goal here is certainly to be able to maximize that treatment, maybe with the right amount of product, so that patients will, you know, minimize the amount of bleeding.
Okay, let me ask you a question. You know, you have made very compelling arguments for PK being a very important tool to use. But if we look at hemophilia treatment until recently, there was not a lot of use of PK. So I would expect that there is an explanation. Can you comment on barriers or why PK is not used as much as we would expect?
Yeah, I mean, I think PK, I mean, certainly is an important, I guess we can call it tool, but it certainly has a lot of challenges. You know, if you look at it, it could be quite complex. You have to understand that, you know, the recommendations to do, let's say, an individual PK, first of all, you need multiple points, time points of blood draws, that the recommendation is anywhere from 9 to 11 points, and that, to begin with, is quite difficult. This usually happens, you know, for the factor 8 between maybe 48 and 72 hours. So for factor 9, it can take even longer. And that is certainly a big barrier from many perspectives. One is the patient or the family. You know, this individual has to come multiple times or stay the whole day in one of the hemophilia treatment centers, you know, getting blood draws. And that is certainly a little bit complicated. Now, in the other part is also recommended that these patients have a washout. And the washout period can be maybe five times the half-life, which is also a long time, and that might put the patients at risk of having a bleed as well. So I think that those are variables that need to be taken in consideration. Now, the other thing, once you get all that information back, you need, you know, a software, you need some complicated calculations to be able to come out with the different variables. You know, what is the area under the curve? What is your half-life? What are your peaks and troughs? All that information is not easy to obtain as well when you try to do, you know, an individual PK. So I think, in general, those have become more cumbersome. I think they're helpful, but they're more difficult, really, to be able to do. And it also depends on the population. If you take a child, it's going to be even more difficult to be able to obtain this amount of samples.
And I might just add there that, you know, because of all those difficulties, and I think before the extended half-life products became available, I think the question for a lot of us was, is PK really necessary? You know, I don't think we really realized how impactful it was until we started to really pay attention to the differences between the EHL products and the standard half-life products, and then, as we were just speaking, between the individual products as well. So a lot more attention in the last several years focused on PK because the products are different from each other. That combined with the barriers, as Miguel just explained, really put us in a situation where we needed a better way to do this. And I think we might get to some of that in our conversation going forward. But we're at a place now where we have the ability to do it, fortunately, because we need to do it.
Right. And I completely agree with you both. And I think that the need or the curiosity of measuring the half-life of extended half-life concentrate has provided a great drive to try overcome some of these barriers. So here is where population PK came into place. How can we define an individual profile by only taking two or three data points during a standard prophylaxis regimen, avoiding the washout, avoiding the standard dose, and avoiding the impossible request to our patient to come back to clinic for 11 data point for 11 blood draws? And you have said very clearly, kids, children, they will not be available for that. So we can do that by studying the PK in large population. On the slide we have on screen, on the left, there are the three measures. Now, you could draw two different lines through those three points, and you cannot really tell if the green or the red one is the appropriate one. But if you draw many of those samples in many different patients, and you draw all the possible lines, then you can explore how the variability between those lines correlates to the population characteristics. And there are essentially three main sources of variability. One is the inter-individual variability. Individuals are different. So we need to take into account that we expect some difference and knowing what the range of variability we expect in that population. The second is the covariates, the height, the weight, the body mass index, the blood group, they all contribute to making the curve be steeper or flatter and the clearance being faster or slower. And the third source of variability is the lab error. We all know that coagulation lab, they have tests that are precise but with some random error. Taking that into account help us using 3 points and get a precise profile. So if you translate this knowledge into knowing how each of the concentrate you were describing to us before, Mark, behave in the population, then you can use that information for a single patient. So if we think, for example, now on the right of a patient, let's call the patient Jamal, and we look at the population he belongs to, we look at the leaflet for, say, GV or a lactate, we will have some average value in the population. And we may know from the study in Canada that the value for adenovate and a lactate are essentially the same. But that's the average. Let's move one step closer to the truth. Now we take into account the weight, the age, the height, the blood group. Now we know that the expected half-life for that patient is the blue dashed line. So it's slightly different from average. It may be better, may be worse, but it's different. Here is where we add 2 measurements. So we do 2 measurements, and we can now see the red line going through the measurement we have taken. We don't need any more 9. We don't need the washout. All of this can be done during standard prophylaxis, but building on the knowledge of the population, we can draw the almost perfect line for the individual patient. Here is where population PK may help us. And if you translate this into practice, you can essentially do this into a single clinic visit. I'll show you what we do at McMaster. Essentially, the patients spend about 3 hours in clinic, and when he comes in, you take a pre-dose sample. Then you give him an infusion. And then the patient does all what he does during the clinical visit. So the physio assessment, speak with the nurse, check the diaries, and so on. Before he goes home, you take a last sample. And that's about 3 hours in our setting. So you have now 2. You have the pre-dose, you have a dose, and you have a 3 hours. If the patient can come back, you'll ask him to be back the day after or after 2 days, and you get a late sample, 24, 48 hours. That's very informative if you are interested in the trough. If the patient cannot come back because he lives 4 hours apart, you can ask him, okay, when you gave your previous infusion, and you record that information, how much you gave and when, that information will relate to the pre-dose. The pre-dose is essentially a late point for the previous infusion. At this point, simply in 3 hours, you have collected a pre, a peak, and a late point. That's all what you need to do a profile. No washout, no standardized dose, and just 3 hours in the hospital. That's possible because of the population PK approach.
So here, I guess, I think it's very important, the points that you brought, especially, you know, that washout period for us is so difficult to do or that we were used to doing, you know, where you had to tell the patient, oh, you have to make sure you don't infuse for 3 or 4 days, which was very difficult. And some parents will not accept that
right
at all. So, you know, my child, or either he's in very, you know, a lot of activities, or the risk of bleeding is always there. So I think that is a very important point that, you know, in 3 hours, you might be able to get the information that you really need to be able to get some accurate calculations. And you don't need the washout period for that. And you can even do another point, which could be random, is my understanding.
Yes.
And I think well, another important point, I mean, you mentioned this, Alfonso, the ability to apply this to patients who don't necessarily live close to us. So we have many patients that live 4 or more hours from our center. And so staying for a long time to get multiple points or a late point, you know, is certainly problematic. But if we can use the dose from the day before and use that as the late point, we can gather all that information in one clinic visit, regardless of how far the patient lives from our center. So this really breaks through a couple of those barriers that Miguel spoke to earlier in terms of being able to obtain this information.
And I don't treat children. I'm an odal treater, but I know of pediatricians that take an early sample in one visit, and then 3 months after, when they see the patient, take the 24-hour and then the 48, and then they lump the data together. And get a PK.
Yeah, I think this even can apply for in the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can tell you in our experience, we do satellite clinics where we travel over 600 miles to see patients, and we only see them once or twice a year, and only for a couple hours. So this will be something that could be very helpful. When the patient just comes in, we do that within 3-4 hours, and we get the information that is useful.
Now, of course, this is easier to apply in practice, but from the last barrier you mentioned, computationally, this is more complicated because you need to study a population, you need to build a model, and then you need to apply to sparse data from one individual. This is beyond the capacity of most of our clinic and would not be possible if not using tools like WOPS, WOPSIMO. WOPSIMO is available online, is available for free, is a product of McMaster University and a large network of collaborating center across the world. And it does for you the math in the back end, let you handle measurement in your patient, input it in the system, get out the result, and use them for practice. Now, may I ask you to comment on, I know you both use WOPS, on how usable and how easy or difficult it is to use it in clinical practice, how valuable it is.
Yeah, we started using this this tool shortly after it became available. I think initially mostly out of curiosity, but it didn't take very long to really see the translation of this information into adjustments in our clinical practice. So we, for the first time, had a tool that was easy to use and able to give me information that I can use at the clinical level with an individual patient to either make sure that his dose is appropriate or to figure out how to adjust the dose to make it a better fit in terms of protecting him from bleeding. And then when we started looking at switching patients from the standard half-life to extended half-life products or changing from product to product, perhaps using this tool to validate that whatever regimen we use for the next product is also going to be protective, I would say this tool has been a significant advance in our clinical practice in the concept of individualizing and tailoring the prophylaxis like you spoke about, Miguel.
Yeah, I fully agree with Mark. And actually, when the extended half-lives came out, this made a huge difference.
Yeah.
I mean, because we were just doing, you know, random. We were not really sure, you know, when to do the testing. And this made things very simple. I mean, with the use of this app, it certainly simplifies the interpretation, which is very useful for us. You know, we don't have time to be doing all these calculations. If you can go in there and put, you know, plug in certain variables that are very easy to get, you get really a lot of information that could be helpful. In our experience, we do a lot of surgeries, and this has been really helpful, even for the standard half-life products and the extended half-life products.
You know, a couple other things come to mind. You mentioned switching to extended half-life products and how this tool helped. You know, we had a lot of patients that were hesitant to make the switch. You know, the concept of extending the interval between doses can be scary for patients because if it doesn't work, they find out because they have a bleed. And you know, that's not an easy thing to convince someone to take a chance on. With a tool like this, we could take a look at their numbers and we could give them, you know, a high degree of confidence that we know where they're going to be, where their trough is going to be at each given day. And take some of that guesswork out of it, so we don't have to wait to see if a bleed happens to know if the interval was right. We actually have data. And then the other thing that I really have noticed is the degree of engagement of our patients. So when we sit down with a patient and we can pull up his individual data, we can show him his graph, we can show him his trough levels at various time points, The degree to which the patients are now connected and engaged in their treatment in decision-making around how to adjust that treatment is significantly enhanced by the use of this tool.
Great point, Mark. And actually, these give us a clue to move to our third objective. I think we made the point that PK is useful and PK is feasible. But you mentioned the engagement of patient. Now, our third learning objective is how can we integrate approaches for shared decision making in our care of patients with hemophilia A. Mark, can you get us started by commenting on models of care for hemophilia?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different ways to deliver hemophilia care, and I think for a long time, you know, there's been sort of debate, perhaps, about what the best way to do that is. There was a group that was brought together 3 or 4 years ago. It was a collaboration between the National Hemophilia Foundation, or NHF, and McMaster University to bring together key stakeholders across the community of hemophilia and to really take a look at the evidence and, you know, what are the best practices for delivering optimal care to patients with hemophilia. And they looked at really two main questions. The first is about the care model. So is an integrated care model versus a non-integrated care model? What does that really mean? Integrated care model means, it's a multidisciplinary team of providers from different disciplines, all focused on the care of a patient with hemophilia. So it's the model that we all have in our comprehensive hemophilia treatment centers. And the data and the experience certainly show that that's the preferred way to deliver optimal hemophilia care. The second question they looked at is, what are the components of that integrated care model that are really crucial? So the presence of a hematologist, a specialized nurse, physiotherapist, social worker, access to specialized coagulation lab testing expertise to help with these assessments that we've been talking about. Those are all key components to this multidisciplinary integrated care model. Now, of course, we all work in big hemophilia treatment centers where that's what we do, that's what we have access to, and it's important, I think, to call out that not all physicians who are seeing patients with hemophilia may work in a center like that. So although this may be the optimal model, we know that not everyone has access to all of those resources. But coming back to WAPS, you know, that is something that everyone has access to. It's web-based, and it's not difficult. And so even if you don't work in a center that has all the resources that a big HTC like ours might have, you still have access to some of these really important tools. And I'd also add that, you know, you mentioned satellite clinics, Miguel. I think that's part of how we see our role in this community. We're fortunate to practice at big centers with lots of resources. You know, we're there to be a resource for the community. So if a physician is seeing a hemophilia patient in the community who may not have all the resources we have, I think all of us would say, yeah, I'd be happy to pick up the phone and talk to that individual and help them with a consultation or help them through a question, maybe give them some advice about how we use tools like WAPS to improve care of our patients and be there as a resource for the community.
Or even the patient can go, you know, one time a year to do a visit, and we can do a PK very easily and be able to do a comprehensive visit and give recommendations back to the community.
Yes, and WAPS can share the PK with whoever is part of the team, both being on site or remotely. Very good. Now, may I ask you, Miguel, to help us getting into the shared decision making process, no matter if we are now in a HTC center or community hematologist, what is shared decision making?
Yeah, I mean, this is a concept actually that started in the late 1980s, which was, based on patient-centered care, where there was a call of attention to the clinicians and to the health system to maybe get a kind of the approach to get away from the disease and focus more on the patient and the family. So it is an approach where the physician or the healthcare professional with the patient, you know, make a decision based on the best evidence that there is available. And I think this is critical, and this is something that, you know, at least most of the hemophilia treatment centers practice, where, you know, now that we have multiple options for our patients, I think it's important to, you know, sit down with them and explain to them, you know, what are those possibilities, what are the benefits, what are the risks, and together make a decision, you know, with the family or the patient if he can do it, to be able to have the best outcome. I mean, I think that is critical to be able to have the patient's values. You know, what do he think? What is his expectations that it's going to happen with this treatment or the other? You know, there are certainly certain decisions that maybe they'll not have a lot of options, like maybe surgery, you know, but you might have options on maybe how are you going to treat that surgery, what product you might use in that surgery. But it's important to be able to get together with the individual or the family and have that discussion, because I think that will certainly have a better outcome. And I think even the adherence is going to be probably much better when the patient really understands what are we talking about.
I heard a lot of terms that I'm sure will resonate with the with our audience: value, value-based care, outcome, and outcome-based care. You mentioned adherence, and you mentioned engagement, involvement. Do you want to make any specific example in the hemophilia space of shared decision-making implementation or application?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see it in our practice every day. You know, when we have, let's put an example, our adolescents. You know, it's for them, certainly priorities sometimes change, and maybe treatment for the hemophilia is not in the top of their list. You know, they're doing other activities and having other things happening in their life, and what we usually see is they'll start being less adherent or to their prophylaxis. You know, and that's when, you know, we start seeing by their logs, by the way when they come in, by their infusions, you know, that the patient is really not doing what he's supposed to do and he's having breakthrough bleeding. And that's when, you know, I think a tool like this, where we will have, let's say, already his PK, we can sit down with him, we should be able to explain the graph, you know, because you can see very easily, you know, what time does it take for him to get, let's say, to 1%, 2%, 3%, depending on, you know, what is your goal, that target level that you want. And the patient will be able to really understand very well. If you want to make a decision there that, well, let's try maybe an extended half-life product, let's say, for you, that you're having difficulty maybe three times a week. Maybe we can, based on the information that we got from your PK, we might be able to put you in twice a week, and this is that rationale why we do it. And that has made, you know, a big difference, certainly, for our patients. You know, that's one example that we can bring. And now, you know, there are essential steps in that decision making that we can see here in this slide. And again, is first of all having that participation from the patient and seeing what their expectations are, mm-hmm. and what do they want to get from the treatment. I think that is critical to be able to have, you know, a successful treatment.
Okay. Well, thanks. I'm not sure, Mark, if you want to add anything to the shared decision making in terms of experience or any specific example you want to provide.
Yeah, no, I think it really resonates. You mentioned adolescents, and that's certainly a group where there's a lot of challenges. Adolescence is hard anyway, and then you know you put hemophilia on top of that. But I think really across the age spectrum, so even in our older adults, you know, who didn't grow up on prophylaxis, prophylaxis was not standard of care when they were young. And now that we have the evidence and the tools to do prophylaxis, you know, trying to get those older adults to understand and accept and adhere to prophylaxis, we use this same approach. So, you know, whether it's a change in treatment from a standard half-life to extended half-life product, or going from not on prophylaxis to being on prophylaxis, or really any decision along the way, this approach really applies to all of those aspects of care.
And does it matter how educated the patient is? Any suggestion about patient education?
Yeah, I mean, education is key to all of this. So, I mean, every one of these steps that Miguel is talking about, it's education focused. So, you know, in the context of a clinical visit, whether it's you know, just a provider and a patient in an office, the two of them, or whether it's the whole multidisciplinary team, you know, everyone has a role in education. And certainly in our multidisciplinary clinics, we have multiple interactions with the team, and everyone's doing their part of the educational process. Outside of that clinic visit, though, I think there's a lot of other places where education occurs. So we have local hemophilia chapters that put on educational events and support patients in other ways. There are national organizations, international organizations, NHF, HFA, WFH. They all play a really big role in education and providing support for patients as well. So education is clearly key to optimizing outcomes, and there's lots of ways that happens.
So Mark, Miguel, thank you very much. I'd like to continue as long as we could, but we are getting close to our timeline. So I'd like to summarize three main SMART goals from our conversation. I'll start from the end. Implement strategies for shared decision-making in clinical practice. Translate data from head-to-head comparative studies on extended half-life products in the management of patients with hemophilia. And last, adopt a PopPK approach to simplify and tailor treatment in practice. Thank you all for joining us. I encourage you to visit the CME Outfitter website for a comprehensive list of clinical resources additional educational activities for both providers and patients. Welcome back. Thank you for sending over your question. We have a bunch of them here, and we'll do our best to address them. So the first one is about pain and use of pain medication. Can any of you comment? Do you see these, or you have any recommendation for managing chronic pain and particularly opiates in our patients?
Yeah, that is a really kind of a loaded question. I think hemophilia is unique in that our patients experience both acute and chronic pain, and sometimes at the same time. So there's acute pain related to bleeds. There's chronic pain related to the damage from those bleeds, and this can be very difficult to manage both of these components at the same time. Obviously, with the increased awareness of opioid use in our countries in the last several years, there's been a lot of attention paid to this. You know, I think one of the things that's important to recognize is that we don't have a lot of data that supports the use of opioids for chronic pain in particular, especially in the hemophilia population, and yet this is a tool that many of us have used over the years because it's a tool that we had. So I think we're in an era now that even though we have much better prophylaxis, we have much better ability to come up with regimens based on pop PK modeling, et cetera, to prevent bleeds and thereby reduce the likelihood of pain. It's still a big part of our practice, and it isn't going to go away. We try to minimize opioid use, obviously. It's not always possible. I think it's important to be sure that the hemophilia team is part of that decision making. You know, we looked in our center at exposure to opioids, and we found somewhat surprisingly that a lot of opioid exposure was due to prescriptions written not by the hemophilia treatment center, but by our colleagues who might be performing surgical procedures on our patients, thinking that perhaps opioids were the only option because other drugs weren't an option, like the NSAIDs, because of the bleeding potential. And so I think it brought to our attention the importance of making sure our team is involved in the decision making and planning around surgical procedures, with pain management being part of that. It's not just bleed management, it's pain management as well to try to minimize potential opioid exposure.
I mean, I agree with Mark, and I think Mark made an important point, which is that the team, you know, it's important to have also the physical therapist involved in the surgeon, because a lot of the times, you know, these patients have chronic pain with, you know, this arthropathy. Sometimes surgical procedures can really make a difference. Instead of having a patient, you know, on narcotics for a long time, you know, a surgical procedure can definitely change how that patient feels, and that's why it's important to be able to have that team.
Now, I have another question I'd like to comment on, staying in this space. If a patient has joint arthropathy, is there any data that prophylaxis can aid or prevent progression of joint disease?
I mean, I think we have data that is very strong in the pediatric population. Definitely there's data supporting there the use of prophylaxis that will prevent. Now, certainly in the adult population, you know, we don't have prospective really studies showing that it might decrease, but the use of prophylaxis definitely improves the quality of life of those patients. Some of the data came out showed that those patients even had maybe even improvement in the range of motion and definitely the quality of life and preventing arthropathy in other joints.
I would say in Canada, we have started doing joint score every year, and sometimes we see an improvement.
Yeah.
Not massive, but for sure there is no decline, no stable, there is a slight improvement.
To the pain part of that, one thing that we've noticed in a lot of our adults who have existing joint disease and pain, if we get them on prophylaxis that's effective and they adhere to it, over time we see a decrease in chronic pain. And I think that reflects, you know, partly fewer bleeds, but also cooling off of those joints that have been target joints or problem joints for a long period of time. So prophylaxis has a lot of benefits in the adult population that maybe we don't have the long-term studies that we'd like, but we're starting to see data that I think are very convincing that there are clear benefits there, even for those with pre-existing joint
disease. And can decrease the use of the opiates, too, if
you do
a pretty adherent prophylaxis, definitely.
Yeah.
I'd like to keep you on the spot, Mark. I'm sure you are well positioned to answer this question. It says, I've just switched a few patients to GV. Do you have any experience on dosing intervals of every 7 days in male adult patient? Any risk of developing inhibitors in the long term?
Okay, so I guess there's two questions there. One is about the extended dosing intervals and one is about inhibitors.
Yep.
I'll take the inhibitor one first, maybe. You know, inhibitors are certainly possible with any factor VIII product. In the clinical trials that led to Givi's approval, we didn't see any new inhibitors, but important to note that these were all previously treated patients, and so we wouldn't expect to see a lot of inhibitors in that population. In terms of the dosing intervals, you know, it's interesting, from the same data, from the same study, if you look across countries, what's on the label is different. So in some countries, every 7-day dosing is on the label. In the U.S., it's not. And I think regardless of what's on the label, you know, we usually start with a recommended dose, but here is where we use that population PK tool. We use WAPS, and we see that for some patients, yes, extending the interval out beyond 5 days is in fact doable. We know from the clinical trial there is a subset of patients who did very well on extended interval dosing, but it's not everybody. And so identifying who they are, using tools like WAPS to sort that out, it usually becomes pretty clear. And so we definitely have patients in our center that are on those more extended interval dosing regimens and are doing very well. But we don't go there without having some reason to believe it's going to work. And this is where the PK testing really comes into play.
Thank you. I'll take the following question for myself. It's about risk of inhibitor development around switching. And we did a systematic review a few years back in blood, and we couldn't find any signal that patient who switch more often are more prone to development of inhibitors. And as you were mentioning, inhibitors are always possible, but once the patient has gone beyond the 50 exposure days, staying on the same molecule or changing doesn't really affect the risk of inhibitors. So we should be reassuring our patient that if they see better value in a shared decision making process in a different concentrate, there is no concern as to inhibitors. That's my take. We are in the process of updating that systematic review. I'm not aware of any different signal. Are you concerned about inhibitor when you switch?
No, I mean, we have probably a similar experience in our population because of the geographic location. We do have a lot of patients that are uninsured, so we have to use whatever product is available. And they switch constantly, and we haven't seen any difference among the products.
Okay, let's switch gear. This is a question from a OB-GYN and says, can you comment on prophylaxis and best practices prior to delivery and C-section? Any of you likes to take this one?
Yeah, I mean, we do have quite a bit of experience, you know, managing, you know, females with hemophilia or carriers, and I think that's when it's critical to be able to involve that individual early in the hemophilia treatment center or with a hematologist. We usually recommend checking levels usually in the third trimester, especially with the factor VIII. You know, they can have some increase in their factor VIII depending on how low they are, because we do have females that have a lot of variability where they can be very low, though they can be normal, or they can be average levels. So it's important to be able to have that level at least in the third trimester to make a plan for that delivery. Either it's a C-section or is a vaginal delivery or is it going to get, you know, epidural anesthesia. I think it's important to be able to know that level. Because if the level is definitely low, that individual most likely need to be replaced because the risk of bleeding is increased. So we do try to follow those patients constantly, and once they get into the hospital, have an available hematology team also to be able to give those recommendations. Now, the factor IX, usually there's not a lot of variation, but it's important to know what their baseline level is as well to be able to do that. And then once the postoperative period, is also important to follow levels, because especially the factor VIII level, you know, as the estrogens drop post delivery, the levels are going to be decreasing as well. And it's important to monitor because some of those patients might need replacement, you know, a few days later, or depending if it's a bigger procedure like a C-section, might need a, you know, prolonged treatment based on what the level is.
Thank you. Then we have a very important question. Thank you for asking this question. I am an emergency physician and would like recommendation on managing this patient in the ED who present with epistaxis or even post-trauma. I think we will all need to say something about this. Why don't you start, Mark?
Yeah, so when it comes to the emergency department management, the first thing that popped into my mind is know where your local hemophilia center is, know how to get a hold of them. If you're working in an emergency department in an institution that has a hemophilia center, then you're automatically connected. But if you're not, knowing where you're going to call for help is really important. The second component is, you know, if the patient is connected to a hemophilia treatment center, they should have an emergency treatment recommendation somewhere on file. You know, it's going to be in the medical record, but if you're outside that system and you can't access it, we give a copy of that to all of our patients. We encourage them to have availability of that. And, you know, now with smartphones, I tell all my patients, just take a picture of your treatment rec and have it on your phone. You can pull it up. You can show the ER doc. It's got the basics of how to get started. And most importantly, it's got our contact information so that we can be reached to lend that advice. So I think those are the first two steps in emergency department management.
Right. And I think it's important to, you know, especially like Mark says, if that patient is, for whatever reason, not connected or is in another hospital that they don't know this individual, I think it's important to ask a few critical questions. One is, what type of hemophilia you have? Do you have hemophilia A or you have hemophilia B? And the second question, do you have an inhibitor or you don't? Because the treatment is really going to make a big difference. Now, we encourage all our patients to have medical IDs, and they can have it in different ways, and that also could be very helpful. In our case, for example, we give them also a medical card for the wallet that is laminated. We have their diagnosis, their treatment options, and all that, and how to contact us as well.
I'd like to provide a final piece of a day knowledge that I learned by setting up a joint training program with our emergency doctor in Hamilton. And what they suggested is be humble. Not saying this is not their way, but emergency doctors are used to deal with high volume and need to be fast, need to make decision. The most common complaint we get from hemophilia patient is they were not listening to me. I was telling them I had hemophilia, I was telling them I had an inhibitor, and they still said, we know what to do. And they not always did the right thing. So these patients are very educated. Mm. Most of them, they know what their treatment is. It doesn't mean they treat themselves. They come to emerge, they need help, they might be in trauma, but don't underestimate their suggestion in provide, if they are conscious, of course, in providing care to themselves. Because they often know exactly what is needed, they just are unable to treat themselves.
Yeah.
We
just
give
one
them
comment.
Please.
Sorry. About, you know, specifically about the, I think he said epistaxis.
Yep.
You know, the use of antifibrinolytics could be really important in this group, no matter what type of hemophilia, inhibitors or non-inhibitors. That could certainly be maybe the initial approach until he finds out more information about this patient.
Yeah. Right. And I would say in doubt, treat. There are very little side effect of treatment besides the cost. If there's any doubt, if the patient banged his head and you don't know, it takes time to get a CT scan, treat first and do the diagnosis later. It would cost much more not treating early a cerebral hemorrhage if that's going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly. I was just going to say that exact same point, yeah.
Good. Okay, so let's move on. Diagnosis. Can you comment on lab testing for accurate diagnosis? How do we best refer this patient? What test and when so hematologist does not further delay diagnosis?
So the initial diagnosis of hemophilia?
It looks like being the initial, yes.
So, you know, it's actually not that complicated. Whether it's factor 8 or factor 9 deficiency, the basic coags are the place to start. So the PTT is going to be significantly prolonged if they've got hemophilia. The important thing is that you can't tell from that whether it's factor 8 or factor 9 deficiency. You do have to have the ability to do a factor level to make that distinction. And so this isn't certainly available in all hospitals and all labs. These are going to be a send out. You know, back to the emergency situation, if you're in a situation where you don't know which one it is, because factor 8 deficiency is much more common than factor 9, that would be the first guess. We wouldn't want to do it that way, of course, but really simply being able to do a factor 8 or 9 level. I think the step before that, though, is recognizing it. You know, this is a big issue in the mild patients who don't always come to attention early in life, and that's a little bit counterintuitive because you think for a congenital disorder, as you mentioned, at the very beginning, you know, congenital means you're born with it, therefore we should know about it from day one, and that's not always the case. We have mild patients and even some moderate patients in our center who weren't diagnosed until adulthood. And some of them had been in contact with the healthcare system, but people didn't recognize the clinical presentation as one of mild or moderate hemophilia. So awareness is an important part of early diagnosis as well.
Yeah, I think it actually makes an important point because I can tell you, I still diagnose mild patients 2-3 a year, brand new patients that are adults.
Yeah.
They had no clue they had a hemophilia. And I think it's important to go back to the basics. You know, if you're in front of a patient, you have to ask yourself, is that, why is that patient bleeding? Is that normal? You know, and get also family history. Family history is critical. You know, not always is going to be there, but I think a lot of the times, if we really dig and ask the right questions, you're able to see, well, there seems to be a pattern here. And if that patient has a, why is that, is he bleeding? And then do the testing like Mark says. You know, the PTD could be very helpful, but for the very milds, you might, you know, not be able to get the right information. And that is when it's important to have that high suspicion that this could be a congenital bleeding disorder and then do the right testing.
Okay, I have a question for you, Mark. With EHL products, do it show long-term efficacy, side effects? Does B domain truncated or deleted reduce side effects? So three questions.
Yeah, good question. So I'll take the last one first. So we don't have any evidence to suggest that the presence or the absence of all or any part of the B domain makes any difference in terms of efficacy or safety long term. So the B domain is not necessary for the coagulant function of factor VIII, and it doesn't appear that removing all or part of it makes any difference in those outcomes. So that's pretty straightforward. In terms of long term side effects, you know, I can say we so far have not seen any, and I think, you know, it's important to recognize that the first EHL drug was approved in 2014, but the clinical trial programs began several years before that for actually all these drugs. And so although some of them have become more recently available, you know, we do have a good amount of historical experience if you include the clinical trial programs. I think we're pretty safe to say we've got at least a decade's worth of experience with most of these products, and we so far have not seen any long-term side effects or efficacy concerns in the long run. So I don't think at this point there's any reason to really be worried about that. Although it's a relevant question given our historical experience in the hemophilia community, but these products are safe long term.
Okay, let's stay on treatment choices. This question says, ask, can you talk more about how to choose a treatment? Male, mid-50s, with history of hypertension and CVD, what drives your treatment choice? Let's assume it's a severe, I would say. Yeah. It doesn't specify, but I would imagine it's a severe. So anything that would make you choose one treatment over another in a case like this?
Well, I think it's important first to figure out the phenotype. If he's a severe individual in his 50s, I mean, I assume he's probably been on prophylaxis or some sort of prophylaxis, which I think is important. Now comes the issue if he has coronary disease, has hypertension. I think our patients need to receive the same treatment as the non-hemophilia population. You've got a male with all these risk factors, ideal is to be able to treat him to prevent complications. So if he needs, let's say the cardiologist recommends a cardiac cath, recommends a stent, recommends to be on antiplatelet agents, I think we should be able to try to provide that, you know, to be able to maximize his treatment. And, you know, some of the things that we do nowadays with these patients, you know, if they're in prophylaxis, try to then be able to maximize that prophylaxis where he can use antiplatelet agents so he doesn't bleed. I mean, I think the cutoff, there's really no study showing what is the cutoff, you know, that threshold for hemostasis. I can tell you my experience, you know, to use especially, let's say, aspirin alone, usually patients with 10% are do fine with it. If you want to add Plavix and aspirin, you know, two antiplatelet agents, certainly will probably, my aim will be a little higher, might be 15 to 20% try to keep this patient from having, you know, bleeding due to the medication, but certainly they will benefit. And I think we all have patients on antiplatelet agents that are receiving prophylaxis. And even we have now moderates that never been in prophy, but now because they need to these antiplatelet agents, they're now in prophylaxis with factor VIII so they can receive their antiplatelet agents.
You know, this question really, I think, also touches on a very important aspect of this, which is, you know, cardiovascular disease. We have to think about primary prevention of cardiovascular disease. And I think in the hemophilia community, you know, for a very long time, it wasn't relevant. Patients didn't live long enough to develop cardiovascular disease, and that's no longer the case. We expect an individual with hemophilia today to have a normal lifespan. And so thinking about the causes of cardiovascular disease, hypertension, diabetes, cholesterol, smoking, all that primary care, primary prevention is really crucial for this population because managing it is going to be more complicated. And that's, I think, not something that we've spent a lot of time thinking about, in part because it wasn't relevant. We've been focused on treating the bleeds, developing safe products, and all that's great. But thinking about other comorbidities, especially in the aging population, and the importance of primary prevention, This also gets back to effective prophylaxis for kids and young adults. You know, we want them to stay physically active to help keep their weight down, to help them be healthy overall, because that will eventually translate into hopefully less risk of cardiovascular disease. But the key to that is having effective prophylaxis so they can be active. So it's really all part of the same paradigm, which is an overall healthy lifestyle to reduce complications and comorbidities beyond hemophilia.
Now, if this was a moderate or mild patient with this risk, cardiovascular risk profile, and he was in need for surgery, I would imagine I would choose for him a standard half-life product. I need to cover the surgical period, maybe the rehabilitation later on, and then he might not be exposed anymore. Should this patient be a severe and on some form of prophylaxis, would you have any concern using a long-acting since he has cardiovascular risk, or you would feel that actually he might allow more space for aspirin? What would be your decision-making process?
Yeah, I mean, I think I feel pretty comfortable as long as I am able to monitor that individual, you know, see what his peaks, what his troughs are. Usually you don't get to very high levels unless you're using, you know, large amounts of factor, which usually doesn't happen. So I still feel very comfortable to be using either standard or extended half-lives. You know, for a surgery, like you mentioned, maybe you go with a standard half-life. It's probably easier while in the hospital. But otherwise, you know, if you can accommodate a profile for that individual that he doesn't bleed, I think that I still feel very comfortable.
Yeah, I would agree.
Now I have two $1 million questions. So one is, can you talk about how to extend intervals in patient? Do you move one day a week or one day a month and keep moving until they bleed, then go back?
So this gets back to shared decision making. I mean, the approach is gonna be a little bit different with each patient and with each family. We obviously want to avoid bleed as the marker of needing to go back. We want to avoid that. And this is, again, as we said during the program, the importance of the PK modeling to help us understand where the limits really are. In terms of whether you go, you know, a day at a time or how you do that, it really is depending on the patient's goals. What is the patient's goal? Is the patient's goal to extend the interval as far as possible, or is the goal to keep the trough above a certain amount to allow certain activity levels? And so the answer to the question really depends on those initial conversations in that whole shared decision-making process, understanding the patient's goals, because they may be different than my goals. You know, we have goals for our patients, but their goals are going to be critical to understand for the plan to be successful.
Yeah, and I think in part of that is when, you know, maybe something like the WAPS can make a big difference, you know, for these patients, because, you know, you can make all different calculations and try to figure out what might be the best regimen for that individual. You know, if we're talking that it's going to be a difference between a couple percentage between one and the other, it might not be safe to maybe do that. You know, if you're talking, you know, certainly bigger numbers, then you might say, well, you might be able to extend it one day more. But again, like Mark says, you have to have that patient's input. Because if you tell him, you know, if you do this change, you could have a risk of bleeding, he might not want that, and he'll be happy to stay with the regimen you got right now. So I think it's that common decision.
I would agree with you both that first is goal setting, risk taking. I also would strongly agree with you that we tend not to wait for a bleed. And if I wear my Canadian hat, we had practicing for years the dose escalating protocol,
yeah,
in Canada, where we were treating once a week children and then waiting for bleeds. And if two bleeds were happening, then escalating to twice a week and then three times a week. Now, it's true that there's a group of patients that were okay on once a week, but it's also true that the average joint health of those who had to escalate is less good than it is for those who never bled. So the approach of waiting for a bleed and go back, I would suggest, is not any more justifiable once you have POPPK tools that let you predict that that patient will bleed. Now, doesn't mean that at 1% you bleed, but it makes it easier to discuss that risk. You know, it's very likely, right, if we go one day longer, you will be bleeding. Now, connected to this question, there's another one that says, are bleeding events directly correlated with time below clotting factor threshold? And is joint bleeding direct correlation as well? any other ways to prevent joint bleeding besides prophylaxis? Can you comment on the trajectory of the joint bleeds over time? And I would add, what's the correlation between activity and TRAF? So four pieces. Is there a correlation between bleed and time above or below threshold? Any other way besides factor concentrate administration to prevent bleeds? What bleeds progressively do to the joint health, and what's the correlation with activity? Pick the one you prefer.
I'll start. That way I get the easy part. There's definitely a correlation between time spent below a certain factor level and risk of bleeding. That's well established. I think the activity is really the key, though. So what activities you can safely engage in are different depending on where you are from your dose. So in the first 24, 48 hours, you're going to have a higher level. You'll be able to do more intense activities with less risk of bleeding. When you get to the end of the dosing interval is where you really have to be careful. And so I think the question was, you know, what else besides factor can we use to reduce the risk of bleeding? Part of it is activity modification, but that also really ties back into this whole education piece. Does the patient understand that the risk of bleeding is not a fixed thing every day? It's the same. It's gonna vary, and do they really understand where they are in that PK curve in terms of, you know, today I can get away with this, tomorrow I might not be able to. And that's an ongoing process, and it differs a little bit for every patient. We want our patients to be as active as possible. There's no question about that. It's just how to do that safely. So I think that's actually as important as the prophy part. It's understanding how all these variables intersect in terms of risk of bleeding, and that just requires a lot of education.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And the other thing that is important, I think, is the status of your joints. You know, if you bring a kid with excellent joints and good support from the muscles, from the tendons, you know, that probably will, that might do much better than an individual that has been bleeding all their life, you know, and having terrible joints and contractures. That, I think, patients generally is at a higher probably risk of bleeding. The issue becomes, you know, what is that threshold? And I don't think we really know exactly what it is. You know, there's data supporting maybe 12-15% is the ideal level when nobody bleeds or minimal bleeding. But to be able to achieve that is very difficult, you know, to be able to have everybody at a trough of 12 to 15%. That certainly will be ideal, but I don't think is in the real life really what is happening is so difficult. So I think, again, you have to, like Mark said, you know, look at, you know, maybe their joint status, look at their activities and see how you can maximize the treatment to prevent bleeding or what they're doing. You know, nowadays we have kids doing really a lot of sports and they do quite well, as long as they do an intense prophylaxis. But a lot has to do based on what your PK looks like to get an idea how we can prevent the joint bleeds. And we have patients that maybe bleed one or twice and they might not get any joint disease, while others, you know, with a few bleeds is enough to see some damage. And that's something that we don't have, I think, a good explanation for.
Okay, I have left a few questions that might be handled with shorter answer. We have about 10 minutes left and about 10 questions. So it will be solid fire. People use EAT for pain. Any issues with using EAT?
EAT.
Now,
oh, heat.
EAT.
Yeah.
Warming up.
Yeah.
Now, maybe I'm Canadian and we live closer to the pole. We tend to use ice for pain in hemophilia because it cools down the inflammation and it decreases pain, and is one of the, you know, rice is the traditional way you treat bleeds. So rest,
elevation, compression.
Cooling and compression. So I don't have experience with using EAT for pain in hemophilia, unless we are referring to back pain or other form of eating. Are you able to comment on this one?
I mean, I don't think there's really strong data, you know, to support one or even the other. But I think physiologically, when you warm up, a place where there's inflammation or anything, in my understanding, there is vasodilation, and that could certainly maybe increase the bleed. While if you put something cold, certainly there is vasoconstriction, which might help maybe stop the bleed or, you know, improve the bleed. So that is usually my thought, and I usually do not recommend putting heat in an acute bleed. You know, if it's a bleed, like you said, a back pain that is not related to hemophilia, I don't see why not if it helps. But I don't usually recommend the use of heat for an acute bleed.
Since you are on the spot, I work in southern Florida. We have a large Hispanic population. Are you aware of epigenetics and pharmacokinetics in these populations?
I mean, what I've seen in some visiting some of the centers in South America, that there's really might not be a lot of difference. You know, there are countries where claim their inhibitors, for example, are very low. But when you really look at, you know, the type of products they're using might be very different. You know, now that actually a lot of the recombinant extended half-life products are coming into the different countries in Latin America, I think it's time to really pay attention what is maybe the inhibitor rate in that population, because I think it's going to be very similar to what we see in the rest of the countries that are using, for example, recombinant products. I don't think there is a huge difference in terms of how they behave in terms of phenotype or genotype.
Issues with medical marijuana. Any value or any issues in using it in hemophilia?
So this is going to vary a lot from state to state or region to region in the U.S. depending on the availability. We do have a number of patients that that use medical marijuana to manage their chronic pain. I think the strength of the data in support of that, you know, may be questioned. But certainly anecdotally, we have some patients that seem to derive significant benefit, and I think you could argue, is that better than being on opioids? And there are probably, you know, pros and cons on both sides of that. I do think it's important for us to understand if our patients are using non-prescription medications or things like medical marijuana. So it's an important part of our assessment of their overall pain. What all are they doing? We do have a couple of case examples of individuals being impaired enough from the use of medical marijuana to then be at risk for falling, for example. So it may have good intentions but have adverse secondary outcomes. So it's certainly very timely and something that we need to be talking with our patients about and having an upfront conversation, even though we probably lack the data we'd like to have about the real utility of it.
Yeah. And I think tying to that, nowadays, you know, there's a lot of use of this CBD oil, you know, and we have a lot of patients, you know, that use it. Some of them say it doesn't work. Others say they get some benefits. So I think it's very difficult, really, to establish a good relation between, you know, is it really effective or not? You know, for some patients it might be, for others it might not be.
Okay, I'll take one for myself. Are there certain nutrients, food, or food groups that can affect or change the half-life breakdown activity or otherwise? I'm not aware of any evidence in this field that correlates nutrition with half-life or clotting. What we have seen with warfarin, for example, does not apply in this case. There are medication interacting. Medication that cause bleed are contraindicated, but there's no specific dietary restriction that we impose on our patient. Another question is about, are there clinically meaningful differences for patient change from one concentrate to another? Has this been studied in well-designed clinical trials? There are not a lot of trials designed with the scope of showing a difference. There are now quite a few reports measuring outcomes in terms of bleeding rates or quality of life across a switch from standard half-life to long-acting. I can think of one in UK, one in Japan, one in Canada. I recall one out of US, showing that you can decrease the number of infusion, you can often decrease the bleeding rate, particularly for patients who gain higher adherence, with a variable impact on cost. I don't know if I'm missing anything on this point. Anything else you want to mention in terms of documenting is worth switching?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think there's any clinical trials specifically designed and powered to look at that. We have registry type data and our own observational experiential type data that speaks to that, as you mentioned, but I don't know if there are any specific trials that have really looked at that.
Last question I have focus on is any models for using home therapy that could be utilized in this space?
Not sure I understand the question.
Like home therapy?
And I don't know if home therapy, they meant home care, if there's any role for using home care services or?
I mean, home care, I mean, certainly home treatment is the ideal and is what we all recommend, certainly to be able to, you know, treat patients at home, either themselves, their parents, or sending somebody to do it. Is the best approach, but I'm not sure what else does home therapy mean besides getting infusions.
Sometimes what we use in Canada for patients living far, being unable to do self-injection, we have nurses going at home and do extra training or infusing them when they are, even for a short period, unable to do themselves. I'm not exactly sure. I wanted to ask just in case there was something I was not aware of in US. There's a comment saying that we didn't speak about PROs. Is there any value in PROs in patient-reported outcomes in hemophilia? Now, bleeds are, for a good chunk, patient-reported.
Yeah.
We do scan, we do x-rays, we visit them, but we also trust them when they say that they bled. We are using some scales to measure pain, to measure quality of life, and so on. So it's a very good question. I think would have not fit in the time we had. As well as, and I leave you to comment on anything for the last 2 minutes, there's a question about what's the future of genetic in patients with hemophilia, and please comment on emicizumab experience and data on side effect and dosing. Anyone want to take any of these on genetics, emicizumab, or patient-reported outcomes?
I mean, I think in terms of genetics, I think is useful, especially for genetic counseling. In our clinical practice, actually, I do a lot of emphasis to do genetics, especially in the MILES, because the MILES is a subgroup of individuals that can develop inhibitors if you treat them aggressively, especially now that we have an older population of individuals that are requiring all kinds of surgeries. I'm actually, most of the surgeries we're doing in the MILES actually are non-related to hemophilia. So for me, it's important to know what mutation they have to see if they are at high risk of developing inhibitors, because one of those patients that develops an inhibitor is a nightmare. I mean, it is a big deal for those individuals. So I use it a lot for those MILES. I mean, certainly for genetic counseling, for everybody, it's important for carriers and things like that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I would just add, I mean, in the interest of time, these are all great questions. I think my takeaway from that is, you know, this space in which we work is rapidly changing. There are a lot of new therapies coming. Our understanding of the therapies that we have has advanced significantly in the last 4 or 5 years, 6 years perhaps. It's a time of rapid change, which is very exciting, but it also means there's lots of unanswered questions and lots more work to be done. So I think those questions are all very relevant and very valid. It's just in the limited time that we have, we probably can't do justice to them. But it does really underscore, I think, the complexity of this area right now with all these new therapies and I guess more need for conversations like this to be going on in the future.
I fully agree with you, Mark, and we apologize if we didn't make justice of all the questions. Thank you all for asking. Thank you all for attending. Thank you, Miguel. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure to discuss tailoring prophylaxis with you all. Thank you.